Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, fermentation is an ancient food production method, but it's become hugely popular, both as an artisanal craft and as big business for creating alternative protein. As the sector grows, new ingredients are being created by fermentation, and research is showing even greater possibilities for the future. Now, of course, beer, wine, yogurt, and even silage have been fermented for thousands of years, but modern methods like biomass fermentation and precision fermentation are helping people innovate, not just through new products, but also through huge efficiencies in production. So we're going to look at the science behind fermentation and ask where the sector might be heading. And I'm delighted to be joined by two fantastic experts right on the fermentation front line. Dr. Tim Finnegan is Chief Scientific Officer at Quorn Foods, where he's designed many of the products, processes and intellectual property held by the business. Hello there, Tim.
Hello, Stefan. Thanks for the invitation.
Very good to have you. And we've also got Carlotta Lucas. Now, Carlotta is Corporate Engagement Manager at the Good Food Institute, where she helps support the European food industry and prepare the sector for the arrival of cultivated meat. Hello there, Carlotta.
Hi, Stefan. Pleasure to be here.
That's great to have you. Now, I've mentioned the growth in fermentation as an industry. Can you, Carlotta, give us an idea of where fermentation is being used currently and maybe some of the more sort of slightly surprising places?
Yeah, absolutely, Stefan. So, you know, as you mentioned, fermentation has been used for centuries to help process and preserve foods like beer, bread, and tempeh. But now we're seeing companies and scientists leaning in to the potential for fermentation to create proteins and other specific functional ingredients, such as enzymes, fats, flavor molecules, et cetera. And all of this offers just a really exciting opportunity to create products that deliver the distinctive taste and texture of animal products like meat, seafood, dairy, and eggs without farming animals. And one of the major benefits of fermentation is that it can be done almost anywhere. It requires very little land. And so we're seeing major interest from companies and governments around the globe, including areas that have historically had very little food production, like Singapore and the Middle East. Governments there are really interested in fermentation and other sustainable proteins like cultivated meat, because they can grow them there locally and mitigate a lot of kind of the food insecurity risk they've seen. So we're seeing, interest around the globe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm interested in the biochemistry of all this, Tim, and I'm hoping that you might be able to fill in the gaps. So what does traditional fermentation really mean?
Well, at the risk of repeating, as we've said, the fermentation is, of course, so well known for many of the foods that we consume today. But I suppose a simple definition of fermentation could be thought of as metabolism by microorganisms, predominantly bacteria and fungi, to produce new metabolites. And for the food industry in particular, that's to confer sensory, preservative or health benefits, or all three. Now, strictly speaking, I suppose, fermentation is more usually defined as an anaerobic process, with limited or no oxygen. And that commits the metabolic pathways of the organisms to a specific route. So, for example, yeast is committed to the production of alcohol in the absence of oxygen from sugars. But of course, there are new technologies coming along, of which, Quorn is one, which is based on a twist on that, which is aerobic fermentation. So there are new ways of approaching that. I think we should also mention that there's increasing interest not just in the metabolites themselves, but in the organism itself and the potential to impact gut health as a probiotic. But I guess that's a whole other podcast. But it is such an interesting area. And I suppose finally, all from a food industry's perspective, just to acknowledge that whilst we're very interested in fermentation as a sort of future facing technology for sustainable food production, we also spend a lot of time in preventing or delaying fermentations that would otherwise lead to spoilage in food. So yeah, Something of a double-edged sword to it.
Okay, now let's unpack a little bit of this because you've used some words that some of our audience might not grasp straight away. So let's give some really simple definitions. So metabolism, what would you call that? The eating? How do you simplify that?
You know, when we eat food, we digest it or we metabolize it. So we create energy, I guess. Creating life is metabolism. We need food to live, and metabolism is the process by which we all thrive.
And it's so, but you can basically break it up into catabolism, where you're breaking complex substances down into simpler ones, and then an anabolism, where you're creating new products from those simpler compounds. Is that a decent-ish simplification?
No, that's a great definition. Exactly, breaking stuff down, building stuff up. It's the process of life.
Yeah, and when you say you're restricting the metabolic pathways, you're saying that there are certain conditions in which you can define exactly what new substances are created by the microbes that have metabolized the inputs in the first place.
Yes, I think so. And some many instances where, you know, the chemistry is so complex, it's quite difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. But the net effect is actually quite delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. So generally speaking, I mean, are there taste profiles of fermented products? I mean, is it generally, do you lower the pH level? So is it an acidification process, generally speaking?
Well, I guess it can be. I mean, if you're fermenting to produce things like acetic acid or vinegar, that certainly be one of the effects. And thinking about this, I guess is there really a single fermented taste? Because fermentation produces a variety of flavour impacts. But I suppose if I was to choose one to single out from the food industry perspective, it would be umami. Mm-hmm. That sort of wonderful kind of mouth-filling, meaty character that comes from the metabolites, the breakdown products, such as amino acids and nucleotides, you know, derived from fermentation. And they're really important, you know, particularly umami, because some people say it signals to us the presence of protein in the same way that sweetness, you know, signals the presence of energy or bitterness, you know, possible danger. And I suppose a great example of fermentation and umami production is soy sauce, whose chemistry is incredibly complex in the way that it's fermented, but it relies on fermentation of predominantly soya and grain, I guess, by a fungus called Aspergillus. And of course, soy sauce has been with us for thousands of years and is just the most wonderful, you know, condiment that we can use in a variety of cuisines.
Absolutely. And Carlotta, in terms of the results of fermentation, you've got the flavour chemistry, but also has fermentation been used as a food preservation method in its own right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think historically, the power of fermentation has been the ability to preserve food in the past when we didn't have a refrigerator where we can just put our piece of produce or meat in. So I think we can see, yeah, fermentation, the power was really in its usefulness in maintaining food. But now if we look at our kind of what are the 21st century problems we're dealing with, we're looking at climate change, we're looking at public health, we're looking at airborne diseases. And once again, I think fermentation has the power to address many of these challenges. Fermentation is an incredibly efficient system compared to farming animals. Just by feeding a simple feedstock like sugar to a microorganism, you're able to get high levels of protein or other ingredients coming out with a fraction of the inputs, a fraction of the land, resulting in greenhouse gas savings as well as less water use. So I think that's critical right now as we're all working and thinking about how do we get to our Paris climate agreements. And then on the public health side, I think there's a lot of challenges with the way our current industrial animal agriculture system is built, resulting, some may say, in pandemics and, airborne diseases. And fermentation can be a very defined, safe process where we can create the proteins we need to feed millions of people around the world in a much better way.
So I'm interested in how you create protein, because I would have said that the traditional fermentation that I've thought of is about things like bread and about wine, ethanol, gin. Obsessing about gin. And also things like kimchi, you know, vegetables being broken down into new flavors being created. But how does it work with protein, Tim? How do you create protein using fermentation?
It's a great question, and I suppose is as Carlotta says, the really exciting future-facing aspects of fermentation that we're looking at. And I guess that corn is the embodiment, really, of the power of fermentation at scale. And this, I think, scale is something, you know, we may come back to, but that's really important. Mm. Creating healthy new proteins with a low environmental impact. Because if I were to define what we need going forward, it would be that: it's healthy new proteins, low environmental impact. And to understand the origins of corn and its fermentation from which it's derived, we have to go back to the 1960s and a time when the world first was genuinely thought it was going to run out of food. And there's some really interesting texts around at the time. I think it was one by the Paddock brothers, who were looking at, you know, which countries could the US save and which ones couldn't. They couldn't. And of course, things didn't turn out quite that way because of the Green Revolution. And Norman Borlaug, who's credited as the man who saved a billion lives. But even he said what had been achieved through the Green Revolution to transform agriculture at the time was more of a sticking plaster, and that we would face similar problems. You know, and here we are with bells and whistles on, just as he predicted.
Yeah.
But sticking with the 60s and, corn's visionary was Lord Rank, from Rank Hovis McDougall and the Rank Film Organisation fame. And I still think that in 1964, he decided that something needed to be done, and he set his team out to go and find something completely new. And what they were looking for was a microorganism. Mm. Sorry, and this is getting to your question now. What they were looking for was, it was a microorganism, one that would transform the less plentiful the plentiful starch into the less plentiful protein. Now, that's kind of brave because, as you say, Stefan, mankind has eaten microorganisms for thousands of years, but it's usually because they do something to something. So, you know, the examples we've talked about, so production of gin. I didn't know gin was fermented, by the way, but yeah, I'll take your...
Well, the mash is fermented and then you get your fractional distillation. But
true,
you
know. Okay.
Come on. It's all there at the base of it.
It's everywhere. So even things like chocolate, right at the start, is there's a fermentation process when the cocoa is first harvested. So it's kind of everywhere. But as you say, eating the whole of the microorganism, the biomass, if you like, which is a term I know my marketeers tend not to like me using in public forum, but there you go. It's what it is. creating the biomass and creating biomass in a really efficient way from a plentiful carbohydrate source, so protein from starch, if you like.
It's almost magical, isn't it? I mean, the fact that you can do that is quite extraordinary. Can you create complete proteins just by using microprotein?
Totally. I mean, one of the things that I spend a lot of time working with, you know, colleagues around universities is just understanding the nutritional value and creating the evidence base around, well, just, you know, how good is this biomass, this microprotein, as we call it, for human health. And we're finding some incredible examples of, you know, how, for example, you know, being a complete protein, it actually builds muscle slightly better than milk protein, which, to be honest, when we started the research, I would kind of settle for nearly as good as, but actually to find that it was better. And that there are a whole host of benefits. And because the biomass is not just protein, it's protein and fiber, not added fiber, but intrinsic fiber. You've got benefits associated with a fiber-rich diet. So things like, you know, cholesterol maintenance, you know, gut health, but also a high-quality protein all packaged up into what's called mycelia. And these are the sort of tiny root-like structures that I don't know, with mushrooms, for example, you look under the soil, if you've ever seen it, that's what you'd see, these mycelia growing. And in fact, they are everywhere. People now are starting to talk about the wood wide web, these structures of fungal mycelia that kind of connect and talk to each other in quite a... Sorry, it's all starting to sound a bit Lord of the Ringsy now, isn't it? But
no, I like it, I like it.
But in this amazing way. And so it is, we just, you know, there's a really good book by Melvin Sheldrake, I think, you know, all talking about the power of fungi and this untapped, this third kingdom that sits between animal and plant. And what corn have been doing is discovered a naturally occurring member of the fungi family, understood how to create great texture from it, know that it's really sustainable, both in terms of human and planetary health, but I think really importantly, know how to produce it at scale, which is the kind of the challenge that we in the food industry face, because it's, you know, at the risk of stating the obvious, it's great to have a really good idea, but bringing that to commercial fruition is a challenge, and it's taken us about 30 years to get there.
Yeah. Okay. Could you, Tim, paint the picture of a biomass reactor? How do you make microprotein? What is it? Just a big old can, and what do you put into it and what do you get out?
So if you've ever been to a brewery or anywhere like that, it's sort of like that. So, but the fermenters that we use are slightly different. I mentioned earlier that they're aerobic, which is sort of slightly going against the traditional view of fermentation.
Yeah, absolutely.
But these things are 200,000 litre volume. So they're big, you know, they go up about 60 metres. But they've got, to Carlotta's point, quite a narrow footprint. So you start to get a sense when you realise that these things are producing microprotein at 2 tonnes an hour, and just how sustainable that is, you know, in terms of its environmental impact. But they're called airlift fermenters. And what that means is that air goes into the bottom of the fermenter at quite high pressure. To oxygenate, to provide the oxygen for the organism to breathe, goes through what's called a sparge bar, which creates lots of little bubbles. These then rise up the fermenter, eventually lose pressure, and the respiratory gases come off, and that causes the liquid to fall. And so with no moving parts, you get this wonderful circulation of fluid.
Does it smell? What does it smell of?
Nothing, because it's all sealed. And if you ever made beer or bread at home, when you open your tiny little yeast sachet, and this is for me the really amazing thing about corn, so with just a few, it's exactly the same, so just with a few spores, the seeds if you like, we put those into about 200 mils of a glucose solution just to bring it back to life. That then goes into 5 litres. That 5 litres then goes into 200,000 litres. So the dilution, I can't do the maths in my head, but it's really spectacular.
It's pretty damn good.
And that sort of then starts growing. And this is the beauty of fermentation, because it's a biological process. It's growing from almost nothing, I mean, literally a milligrams, to after 4 days, we can harvest at 2 tonnes an hour of microprotein, because it's grown to that point. But here's the really clever bit for the engineering, is we're able to hold it like that and harvest continuously for about 30 or 40 days. And the engineering in that is phenomenal. And the know-how about, you know, actually being able to do that is hard won. It really, really is. And we stop after that, about 30, 40 days, quick clean down, turn around, off we go again.
Yeah. So can I grow my own corn at home from corn that I've bought from the shops if I feed it the right inputs?
No, because it's been killed. So as part of the harvesting process, we cook it, so it's no longer a viable microorganism.
Okay. All right, that's fantastic. A brilliant explanation, Tim. Thank you so much for that. Now, Carlotta, let's talk about DOSH. It's time to talk about cash, really, because as well as it being a fantastic alternative protein, it's a big industry. Now, you're working with companies across Europe. Where do you see the money going? What sort of types of fermentation, what sort of products, and what sort of R&D?
Absolutely. So last year, we saw about 1.4 billion pounds go into the fermentation industry globally, which was up almost 285% from the year before. So we're seeing massive interest from investors. About a third of that investment went to biomass fermentation startups, companies that are following a similar process to what Tim mentioned, how corn does it. Actually, half of the investment went to precision fermentation startups. Stefan, I know you mentioned that term in the beginning as well. And maybe just to briefly describe what that is, it's the idea of also once again using microorganisms like fungi, bacteria, yeast, and basically turning them into cell factories, telling them, hey, we want you to produce this specific ingredient, whether it's a specific protein or an enzyme. I think the most exciting example that we've seen in the sustainable protein industry so far, or one of the most scaled up examples, is the US company Perfect Day. They've been able to recreate dairy proteins like casein and whey by telling microorganisms that that's what they should be producing. And that's really exciting more on the animal-free dairy side. I think broadly speaking, on the plant-based meat or the animal-free meat side, we're starting to get closer to taste parity with conventional meat. But on the dairy side, it's been really challenging for plant-based cheeses, especially, to get even close to a conventional cheese. Yeah. And I think this is where precision fermentation especially can be a game changer, because we can literally recreate casein in a way that are biologically identical to the casein and whey you get from milk, but just produce without the animal. And then you can mix them with some other plant-based ingredients. And some of these products are already on the market in the United States. And initial feedback from consumers is overwhelmingly positive. So I think that's a really exciting area where this sector is going as well. But maybe to talk a little bit more about the investment side. So I mentioned last year there was almost 1.4 billion pounds in investment, up almost 285%. That's really exciting. I do need to say that most of that investment went to companies in North America. And actually, Europe's fermentation companies only raised about 105 million pounds of investment. That's still up about double of what it was the year before. But
that's rubbish.
It's unfortunate. And to be honest, that 105 million pounds is really driven by two companies. One of them is the German-based Formel. They leverage its precision fermentation process to also develop animal-free dairy. And they received about 41 million pounds last year, which was actually the largest Series A food tech funding round ever in Europe. So I think demonstrates really promising interest from investors. The other company was the Scotland-based Enough, which also developed a form of microprotein. So we are seeing interest, but we need more, especially here in Europe. There's a lot of great startups working in this area, and we need more support from governments and investors to help these companies scale up.
Mm-hmm. So why is there such a big difference? Is it something to do with the size of the markets? How does the European market compare to the global market?
You know, to be honest, the European market is technically larger than, the US market, for example. So if we're comparing, you know, the US to Europe, there's no reason why investment should be lower here. I think historically, the United States has been a little bit more innovative and or more willing to innovate in their food. Here in Europe, we have very traditional food cultures and maybe slower adoption at times in some countries. Nevertheless, research from around the world demonstrates, and right here in Europe, that consumers are transitioning to more sustainable proteins, including plant-based. They're looking to eat healthier. They're looking for more sustainable options. So I think the consumer demand is there. We just need to continue developing products that consumers want. And there's really three things that drive consumer acceptance. It's taste, price, and convenience. The products need to taste the same or better as conventional animal products. They need to cost the same or less, and they need to be widely available. And I think across the board, we still have work to do. And especially on the scale side, Tim was mentioning that earlier, that is going to be absolutely critical for the fermentation sector and companies to bring down prices and to feed the global population with these more sustainable proteins.
Mm. Now, Tim, there's a bit of a disconnect here, isn't there? Because, I mean, Corn is a British company, started a long time ago, and very much, I would say, a world leader in exactly this. And yet we have Europe lagging behind in investment. Are you surprised by that?
I'm quite why the investment isn't going into Europe in the way that it's going into the States. I don't know. Although I did note you said 105 million pounds was rubbish. And I guess if it was a personal check, S. Gates, you might think differently.
in 1.4 billion pound amount, then it is a bit rubbish, isn't it?
True. Yeah, I mean, so we've actually, at Quorn, we've tried to work out over the years, because there have been a number of owners, just how much actually has been invested in getting to where we are now. And, you know, we kind of lose track after a while. And but to be honest, most of that money was industry funded. You know, it was, you know, the various owners with limited, you know, external investment. That's disappointing, actually. That's quite a new... I didn't realise that we were so far behind the investment in Europe.
Mm. So from your point of view, Tim, I mean, are there some particularly interesting elements that you've seen cropping up? New startups, new techniques that have got you excited?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been in the sector for sort of over 30 years now. In fact, I did my PhD in alternative protein recoveries back in the late 1800s. No, I'm only kidding. It was 1985, actually.
But you have barely been out of the Corn shed for 30 years, basically.
I know. Well, they do sort of wheel me out from time to time and talk to some of my younger colleagues about the early days. And I say, oh, it feels like a lifetime ago. And then I realise for them it actually is. But we've kind of just, certainly back in the early days, we had no idea just how big this was going to be. I guess it was just this vision that we had this notion that we were out to shatter perceptions, that there was a different way of doing things and, you know, creating protein. And you know, very much the focus was on replacing animal protein. But I think from our point of view, it's never been anything other than let's change the balance. That we're actually, it is our addiction to animal proteins now that actually is literally costing the earth. But, you know, to say that nobody is ever going to eat, which some people do, animal proteins ever again, I think is wrong. You know, it's socially, nutritionally, economically, politically very, very important. But the balance is completely wrong. So that's kind of where we want to get to, is to shift the balance more into, you know, plant-based or fungal-based or non-animal-based proteins. Mm.
So what about new developments and anything that you find particularly exciting, both you, Tim, and Carlotta?
Well, I'll just finish that point then, Carlotta, if I may. Then things that all the new startups, I do find them really, really exciting. I mean, it is a vindication, of course, of what we've been involved with for so long. But inevitably the commercial landscape will become more challenging. But of course, that's got to be healthy. And in fact, one of the things that I'm doing with Jim Laird, who's the CEO from Enough that Carlotta mentioned, is we're trying to set up, and there's a lot of enthusiasm for it, we just haven't quite worked out how to do it yet, a coalition, which we're kind of loosely calling the founders of fungi or fungi founders at the moment, which to work pre-competitively, you know, committed to changing the way that we eat, because that is the single biggest question that agri-food, I think, faces at the moment, is how do we change the way we eat to assure a sustainable future? And our belief is that fermentation is an underexploited but hugely important tool in that particular toolbox. So getting together pre-competitively to just kind of, you know, work out how we can support each other until we get into the marketplace. And then, it's, of course, it's the usual gloves off and see who prevails.
Carlotta, any particular new startups, any particular new techniques that you're excited by?
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm really excited about is also the power of fermentation to improve plant-based products. So one of the most famous and successful plant-based products on the market is the Impossible Foods burger. The reason it's so successful is that they have a fermentation-derived ingredient called heme in it, which is the protein that you generally find in meat that kind of recreates that umami, meaty, bloody taste and appearance. There's now a number of startups who are also working in the space that are developing that heme as a B2B ingredient. Here in Europe, recently Paleo out of Belgium announced that they're creating multiple heme proteins. There's Motif Foodworks out of the United States, along with a few others. And I think these types of B2B startups are going to be a game changer for creating better end products, because the end products are only as good as the ingredients and the processing technology that we have. So I think that's really exciting. And more generally, seeing a transition to hybrid product where we combine different types of processing technologies from plant-based, from fermentation, from cultivated meat to really create the best product we can for consumers.
Okay, well, you've all mentioned sustainability as an important part of this. So, Tim, you know, you talk a big talk. Give us some more details about this. Get some specifics. Is there some sort of scale by which fermented protein is better for the environment? And also, I'm interested in what are the inputs? What do you stick in that biomass reactor?
Yeah, it's a good point, and the whatever we say or whatever anybody says, you know, I've always been, you know, absolute that we need a strong and robust and defendable evidence base that is fact-based and not just kind of greenwashing. Now, I started thinking about this quite seriously, or more seriously, in around about 2006, just after the Livestock's Long Shadow report came out. And sort of we had this intuition that producing protein then by fermentation has got to be environmentally more benign than producing animal protein the way that it's produced, isn't it? So we did some work with De Montfort University, actually, in the UK, and, you know, provided them with all the data from our process, and you know, we relied on literature sources for animal protein, and actually found that there was, you know, this intuition was well-founded. Now, we started to talk about that, and of course, inevitably, people say, oh, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? You know, and so how authentic is your evidence? So that's when we say, okay, get that right. So now we work very much with the Carbon Trust, who are a respected NGO, international reach, and everything that we talk about is audited and approved by Carbon Trust. Now, the data broadly split into greenhouse gas emissions, land use, and water use, as that's probably the top three. And if you go onto the Quorn website, you can find what's called the Carbon Trust Quorn Comparison Report, where they've taken all our inputs, all our data, and compared that with the equivalent animal protein, and actually, you know, made it really tough. And they've said, well, okay, we're going to take your worst number and compare it with the lowest number for that particular comparator. And there you can see, for example, that Quorn mince versus beef mince is about 20 times lower in greenhouse gas emissions. But it is a hugely complex area. And I think, you know, if people are genuinely interested in that, rather than me sort of shoot from the hip with sound bites, is there's a very detailed report. Transparency is very much something that Quorn are committed to. And you can read all about it.
Even the maths of saying 20 times lower is pretty complex as well, frankly, isn't it?
So you can read about. So your other question about what goes in, well, it's really quite simple. Any organism, you need a source of carbohydrates, so that's glucose. You need a source of nitrogen, and then vitamins and minerals, a bit like fertilizer that you put on the land, and then the nature does the rest. It grows, and we harvest. Pretty straightforward. The really interesting, if I may, thing for me is where you get your glucose from. Now, at the moment, we derive our glucose from conventional sources like wheat or maize. So as part of, you know, the way that crop is actually is used to separate into starch, bran, and protein. But I've actually started a piece of research now with Imperial and King's and the Rice Research Institute in Manila, and we chose rice because rice straw is such a problem, you know, worldwide. A huge amount of it is burned, causes pollution. But we kind of thought that, well, biofuel technology has been quite good at taking secondary sources like lignocellulose, which is the stuff in plants that makes it woody. And it's left over when the agricultural waste, if you like, it creating glucose. But after that, it doesn't really work for fermenting it to biofuel. But what if we were actually able to take that as a carbohydrate source, ferment it, and create protein? Protein from agricultural waste. Now, how cool is that? That's so we've done a little bit of work, chose rice straw because it is a problem. And we've done a pilot study, which we've published. The economics don't look great, but they never do at this stage, so I'm not too worried about that. But proof of principle.
That's not your problem.
Well, proof of principle is there. And it's sort of, if I kind of look back 30 years, I was mentioning earlier, and say, well, we were just out to shatter perceptions. And I look forward to the next. I think this could be such a big idea. Creating protein from waste. That is, for me, it's a real game changer, but it's just a research question.
But that does sound very exciting. Okay, well, let's get back to the market now and look at some of the challenges. We're looking at the potential for big market expansion. There's infrastructure, there's investment, there's a raw material supply chain, as you say, B2B ingredient sales becoming. What if anything, is holding the sector back, Carlotta? What needs to change to be able to for it to fill its boots?
The number one biggest challenge that the fermentation sector faces right now is the lack of infrastructure, the lack of factories, the lack of co-manufacturing capacity, where startups who are starting to produce these products, they have an idea, they've tested it at pilot scale, and they're now looking to go to commercial scale. They rarely have anywhere to go. We're seeing examples of some startups trying to partner with kind of large brewing companies or pharmaceutical companies and trying to retrofit some of that infrastructure to use them. And that's working to some extent, but we're still at the very early stage of, you know, this fermentation sector. And there is such a high potential and also high expectations of what fermentation can deliver on sustainability aspects, on health aspects, and feeding the world. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to realize that until we build up the global infrastructure needed to actually produce these proteins. And I think there's a couple of players who can play a really big role in supporting and facilitating that. One, I think governments. If we look at the potential for, once again, fermentation to address many of our global issues, you would think governments would invest more in this sector the way they have, for example, in renewable energy. But actually, sustainable proteins, although it can potentially save the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions compared to renewable energy, has 1/20th, 1/50th of the investment or so. And governments can play a really big role in helping build up this infrastructure, but by providing loans and making it easier for these companies to get the funding they need to do so. We also need the traditional food industry to see the opportunity and to play a role here. And fortunately, we are seeing that. Going kind of off the example Tim mentioned earlier about leveraging kind of side streams, there was just a great example a few weeks ago about a German fermentation company, Mush Labs, that's partnering with a beer brewery to leverage their spent grain to use as the input. So we're starting to see partnerships on the ingredient side and on the infrastructure side, but it's not enough. So we're going to need to see significantly more investment.
Stefano, from my point of view, I was just going to build on what Carlotta was saying, that I think you hit the nail on the head, Carlotta, earlier when you talked about taste. From a consumer point of view, you know, taste is absolute. So we talk about sustainability, we talk about health, but unless the product really delivers, then of course it's just a huge disappointment. And it's one of the things that, as the founders of Fungi collaboration, we're going to talk about, which is, you know, assuring consistent quality, because the last thing we want is marketers spending a huge amount of money talking about the issues, persuading somebody to, the you know, purchase whatever product it is, and then going home and going, well, I knew it was going to taste awful, so, and then never buying it again. You know, and we've been there over the last sort of 20 years or so when products were not great, but actually they're getting so much better now. But I think consumer awareness and acceptance of our sector is hugely important, and in a way that taste will deliver. And sustainability, for example, I don't know, if you're on UK average salary and you're worried about, can I even feed the kids this Christmas? And some guy turns up and starts talking to you about the concept of embedded greenhouse gases in your food. Well, who gives a damn? You know, it finding something that actually connects with people outside of the worried world bubble of consumers into people that actually are quite vulnerable to sort of dietary problems, and that could be addressed through, you know, increased plant-based and fungal-based foods, I think is hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so we're talking about sort of the grander scale concepts here, but I just wanted to kind of pour water on things for a second. Let's talk a bit about regulation. Tim, is regulation holding back the industry at any level?
I don't think so. I mean, the regulatory process is still robust and demanding.
As it should be.
Yeah, which I think is right and proper. It varies in its needs, to, you know, dependent on the authority, and inevitably, you know, politics sometimes gets in the way. It's certainly a lighter touch now than when Quorn first applied in, you know, leading up to the first launch in 1985. And probably, you know, a lot of that is because, you know, Quorn has now sold over 7 billion meals worldwide, and a lot of you know, new startups lean into that experience of use as a sort of proof point about, you know, just how great, you know, fungal protein actually is. So I would say it feels lighter touch than it was, but I don't think, and Carlotta, you may have a different opinion, but I don't feel that it's holding back the sector unnecessarily.
Yeah. Carlotta, what's your point of view on this? I mean, I guess the interesting thing really is it holding back investment in the sector?
To some extent, it is. And we've been talking about the different forms of fermentation, biomass versus precision. Biomass fermentation, many companies are using fungal strains that have already received regulatory approval, so they can use them and go straight to market with their products. With precision fermentation, we're seeing the use of new novel strains that enable us to create these unique proteins like casein, whey, egg whites. And those do need to receive regulatory approval. And that itself is not a problem. The important thing is that this regulatory process should be evidence-based and scientific. And what we are noting, if we're kind of comparing regions around the world, is in Europe, the process is quite a bit longer than in other regions. So we're seeing even European startups often focusing on other markets before entering the European market due to the time and the cost it takes to potentially bring a product to market here. So if we're looking at how do we support European consumers in transitioning to more sustainable proteins, unfortunately, at times, I think our regulatory process does slow things down a bit. So I think there's a lot of discussion as well in the sector of how do we engage the regulatory bodies to help them understand these new novel technologies and the role they play.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as I can tell, about 80% of the new companies in the fermented alternative protein space have formed since 2015. I mean, is this growth going to continue, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've been talking about the consumer demand there is for transitioning to more sustainable, healthy products. And I think that's only going to increase in time. The number of startups that are in the space now are going to be scaling with time as well. So right now, they're just kind of maybe putting some initial products out. Over time, they're going to expand. So I think we're going to see a massive growth in the market. And I think one thing that will be essential in this is also, and hopefully will drive this further, is starting to slowly see more government support for the sector. So I think one of the really promising and exciting things that we saw earlier this year was the Dutch government announced a government grant for about £50 million in funding for the cellular agriculture community ecosystem in the Netherlands, which covers both cultivated meat and precision fermentation. And that'll support in helping increase research and infrastructure for that sector. Now we need other countries like the UK to follow suit. I think there's already good steps being taken in the government food strategy that was released in the past year. The UK government highlighted the potential for sustainable proteins to play an important role in, you know, future British food production. But we need to kind of take that strategy and transition to execution as well. And I think that will truly accelerate the growth of this sector.
Yeah. Okay, so we've really got to draw to a close. It's getting far too interesting now. Tim, your last one for you, really. Is there something that hasn't yet been quite mastered in the fermentation world? Is there one bit of technology that you need, or is there one last problem that you really think needs to be cracked to really open the floodgates? What is the big shift that you would like to see?
I probably went a bit too soon on this because I still think the protein from waste idea is the big, from a personal point of view, is a big one. But there are so many others. So improvements in the overall process design, those incremental innovation steps that actually just lead you inexorably towards, you know, increased excellence. There's textural synergies that may or may not exist, you know, between, say, mycoprotein or mycelia and cultured meat. I know there's some work already happening in that area. There's mycelia that are being used by some companies now to create fashion. You know, some great examples about mycelia use in that, and also in building networks. So, expanding mycelia, mycoprotein, fungal fermentation technology beyond food, I think, is a hugely exciting area. But I still come back to that protein from waste because I just think that's so authentic to Lord Rank's original vision, feeding the world.
Yeah,
that seems like a pretty good way of doing it.
Which was, I mean, extraordinary stuff. Yeah. Okay, well, we've got to end it there. Tim Finnegan and Carlotta Lucas, thank you both so much for joining me.
Stefan.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.